I was born into poverty. You know, we were homeless for a time. We lived in a car. My mother became very addicted to drugs. I never met my father, so I was placed into foster care. When I was taken from my mother to the first home, it was the worst feeling that anyone could maybe have. I just remember melting down, crying, tantrums, hyperventilating. My mother was deported. I was doing so badly in school that the teachers thought I might have had a learning disability. My overall IQ score was like 98. I also didn't really know how to read. I was in the bottom of my high school class. I graduated, but just barely. Decided to enlist, went off to basic training. Ultimately, that was the structure I needed. So I went off to Yale. You know, that was where I first witnessed a lot of the kind of strange and silly elite beliefs about everything, including human nature. And then I read The Bell Curve and I thought, oh, like this helped me to understand that intelligence matters and that it's important and that it's, you know, extremely powerful predictor of life outcomes. But then also for people who are less intellectually inclined and aren't academically equipped to do well in school, they need guidance and they need elites in society to help them make wiser decisions.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, as you know, I don't much like talking about race. I think it's a bit impolite. It's controversial, which I don't like. And some people would say it's offensive. But I'm going to make an exception on this occasion because I have with me an example, I would say, of the triumph of race over environment. Possibly, we don't. It's a bit complicated. But that is Rob Henderson, who is a researcher at the University of Cambridge, who went to Yale and has a very interesting background, which he's recently written a book about, which is called
Troubles.
Now, the clue is in the title. The implication is that his background was a bit troubled. And it's quite interesting to think I believe it's known as the Wilson effect, isn't it? That genetic traits become more salient as you get older. Particularly in relation to intelligence, but also other characteristics. And maybe this is what's going on with Rob here. So, Rob, can you tell us a little bit about your background, childhood?
Thanks, Ed. It's very briefly, my book Troubled covers my unusual trajectory, kind of traveling along the class ladder in the United States. So I was born into poverty. My mother came to the U.S. as a young woman from Seoul, lived in California. We were homeless for a time. We lived in a car.
You remember this?
Yeah. And eventually we settled in this slum apartment in Los Angeles. My mother became very addicted to drugs. I never met my father, so I was placed into foster care. Spent the next 5 years living in seven different homes in Los Angeles.
How old were you when you were put in foster care?
3 years old.
And do you remember living in a car?
I have flashbulb memories of the car and, of living in the apartment as well. And I also have documents from the social workers who were responsible for my case saying before the car we were, briefly on the streets. And so...
It was like living in hostels or literally on the streets?
On the streets, yeah. And somehow, I don't know the story here, but my mother acquired a car, lived in the car, then eventually got this apartment. And at age 3, some neighbors noticed the neglect and the squalor that we were living in and called the police. The police arrived, placed me into foster care. They and a forensic psychologist asked my mother where my father was. She didn't know. I went my entire life not knowing anything about my father. I took this 23andMe genetic ancestry test and discovered that my father was Mexican. And so I'm half Hispanic on my dad's side and my mom was Korean. But at age, just before I turned 8, so my 8th birthday, I was adopted by this white working class family.
You were continuously put in different foster homes for relatively small periods of time.
Yeah, anywhere from 3 to 6 months.
And how did that feel, do you remember, when you had to change the foster home?
Well, when I was taken from my mother to the first home and then that first home to the second home, it was extremely upsetting. The worst feeling that anyone could maybe have, at least emotionally and psychologically. And so I just remember, as any 3 or 4 year old child would in that circumstance, just melting down, crying, tantrums, just hyperventilating. And then by the third home and the fourth home, fifth home, I started to shut down emotionally and became, just sort of a coping response, this kind of more stoic reaction to...
Why did you have to keep changing homes?
So the reason why the system is set up this way, one reason is because typically what happens is when a kid is placed into the foster system, someone from the family of origin will re-enter the picture and offer to supply care for the child. So it could be that the mother sobers up and says, oh, I can take the child back, or a grandmother or an aunt or maybe the father. Someone in the family of origin can take the child back. But if a child's been living continuously in a single foster home for an extended period of time, this can create issues around attachment and loyalty. And often a kid, if they've lived with a foster home for a year or 2 years, they don't want to leave. And so every few months, the child is taken to a different home so they never form any
attachment. They don't form an attachment.
Exactly.
That seems to be very cruel.
Yes, it is. It's cruel, but that is what often happens.
Literally so that they don't feel towards others or even feel that they experience a proper sense of love.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so in this case, my situation was strange because my mother was deported after I was placed into the system, because that was not her first run-in with law enforcement. And no one could track down my father, and so there was never any chance of me being reunited with them.
How did she get into the country?
How did she get into the country?
Yeah.
I don't know the full story. I know this might be interesting for you and some of your listeners. So my grandfather on my mother's side, he was a former police detective in Seoul who then became wealthy when he started a fertilizer company and then sent my mother to the U.S. And she was very briefly a university student. And then this was the 1980s in Los Angeles, and so she was partying, doing a lot of drugs, and not particularly focused. And so that was kind of her background.
You remember her? Yeah, you remember.
I don't remember this. This is all.
You remember her?
I remember her. Yeah. I don't know if I ever even met my grandfather. But in the documents from my social worker, they laid out basically whatever family history they had.
Korean? Was Korean your first language?
That's a good question. I don't know, actually. I remember only ever speaking English.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So, but there were not, at least in my memory, very many affectionate moments between my mother and I. So I don't know her ever speaking to me at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you moved through these different foster homes. Each time you created a coping mechanism of being stoical and just accepting this is how life is, or just cutting off emotionally. And you went to school.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and was it known that you were in foster? I mean, was this an issue?
So the teachers knew I was in foster care, and I was changing school districts and changing homes a lot. And I was a very unfocused kid. At one point, I was doing so badly in school that the teachers thought I might have had a learning disability or may have had like an intellectual deficit. And so when I was 7, they sent a psychologist to the home and we did a series of tests. And I have all these this documentation now. My overall IQ score, I think it was like 98 was the overall. But then it was interesting. There was a lot of scatter in the sub components of the test. So my verbal was, I think, 81. And then my quantitative score was like 115. And so it was just like very messy. And I remember taking this test and I was not really giving it my best effort unless I found the question appealing or interesting. Then I would engage, but if they were asking me questions where I was uninterested, I just would not put in the effort. I also didn't really know how to read because I was never read to in the homes. And
really? That strikes me as very surprising. Yeah. I would have thought it was quite middle class people that would foster kids out. No.
No, I mean, it was kind of lower middle class, I would say, but a lot of the homes had upwards of 8 or 10 children living in them, and there's only so much care you can supply to any individual kid. And then a lot of the foster parents, they're not, some of them are great, I'm sure, but the homes that I lived in, there was just like an emotional coldness. And I think what happens for a lot of foster parents is that just as a child would shut down after moving to so many homes, a lot of foster parents, I think, start to withhold affection to kids because if they're worried that if they get attached and then the child moves on, they're also going to have an emotional response to it as well.
Really,
and so they keep a kind of a distance to the children that they're taking care of.
It's a calling system.
Yeah. It's really imperfect. Yeah. And so, yeah, I was a terrible student all throughout my experiences in the foster homes. And then when I was adopted, then I became, a better student.
How old were you when you were adopted?
So I was seven, and I had my eighth birthday, I think, like, as the adoption was being finalized just a couple months later, so.
And how did that process happen? They just sort of pick you?
Yes. Yes, my mother, my adoptive mother, approached the social workers and said she was interested in adoption, and they had kind of descriptions of each child. This was kind of interesting. So they don't actually have pictures of the kids. They only have descriptions and a bit, sort of a brief biographical sketch. And my understanding is that, they don't want the photos to sway people too much. You sort of as a prospective adoptive parent, you read about a particular child and then you can meet them. And you only ever see them in person. And then from there, I'm sure there are plenty of other sort of processes, and the application is, from what I understand, quite lengthy. But was adopted. And so my adoptive parents, it was a working class couple. My adoptive mother was an assistant social worker. And my adoptive father was a truck driver. Neither of them went to university. And that was quite typical of the town that I was adopted into, this small, dusty, blue-collar town in Northern California called Red Bluff, which was, at this point in the late 90s, it was probably maybe 70% white working class, 20-some percent Hispanic working class. And then there were like a handful of Asian and Black families and kids in that town, but it was mostly white and Hispanic. Yeah.
Okay. I suppose from a sort of an IQ perspective, then you have parents whose phenotypic IQ is going to be lower than yours, really.
You think so?
So you're not going to be pushed. If you look at Jim Flynn's idea of his book, where he talks about the importance of who you socialize with for your intelligence, his last book, this means that you, in a sense, they would have been presumably retarding your IQ because the heritability of IQ when you're a child is only 0.2. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the difference between the parents on the genetic level. So what was that like? It wasn't a particularly intellectually stimulating home.
That's right. Yeah, like I said, there was not a lot of oversight from the foster parents. No one monitoring whether I was doing homework.
I mean, when you were adopted,
Once I was adopted, it was better. My case is unusual because, and I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of this, is that typically adopted children do worse than their adoptive parents, because in order to qualify to adopt a child, you typically have to be middle class, intact marriage, jump through all of these hoops and be, kind of a middle class stable home. Whereas children who are being adopted into that middle class home tend to come from extraordinarily difficult circumstances, and they inherit all of the attributes that go along with that kind of chaos and disorder and poverty. Whereas in my case, it was very much the reverse, is that my adoptive parents, didn't go to college. They weren't intellectually curious or anything like that. And I did have that latent ability. It was just never expressed because of the chaotic circumstances of my upbringing. But once I had that stability, and my adoptive mother would actually read to me and read to my adoptive sister, who was their biological sister, our daughter, rather. She was their biological daughter. She became my sister, adoptive sister.
Were they Christians or something?
Yes, they were. Yeah. And so they had a daughter together, but they wanted a boy, and they didn't want to go through another pregnancy.
From an evolutionary perspective, it seems to me there's no question about it. They would be more bonded to their own child than you, and they would probably love it more.
Yeah. Well, that was the case for my adoptive father. So I describe that situation in the book where initially he and I had grown close. But then after the divorce, he cut off contact with me. And so obviously from a kind of an emotional perspective as a young child, it was devastating. And, you know, from there, like a moral, I was 9 years old.
So only 2 years after the adoption?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's a year and a half.
One gets the impression that it was the mother that wanted another child and the mother that would have wanted to adopt a mixed race child or a non-white child. And...
Well, I don't know if she even cared about the race of the child. I mean, it probably didn't. So my adoptive mother was Korean herself.
Oh, I
see. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe she had some affinity for me for that reason, but... Yeah, and so my adoptive father cut off contact with me.
He was white.
And I think, you know, again, from like a cold-blooded evolutionary perspective, it's not entirely incomprehensible. But my mother and I remain close. I mean, I think it's obviously like on the average, I think people are probably more attached to their biological children. But one reason why you see, you know, obviously like religious families are more likely to adopt. And I think they have this kind of commitment to... you know, these kind of Christian moral principles or something. And some of them are able to live up to that ideal, some aren't. And so, yeah, it was, and the other thing was after the divorce, you know, my mother's level of devotion to her faith declined. And, you know, it was one of these things where once the family split up, we stopped going to church and that stopped really being a factor in my life. So we were, you know, it was only about a year and a half.
Were you in any way close to your sister?
My adoptive sister, yes. So again, she was their biological daughter.
Were not caused resentment on her part? How much older was she than you?
She was younger than me. Was 4 when I was adopted. So she's 3.5 years younger than me, 4 years younger than me. There was no resentment. She was a really good kid. Very generous, very nice. She was, and we remain close to this day.
But one would have thought that if you have 2 children, they have an argument. One's your biological child and one's your adopted child. You're almost certainly going to take the child. Seems so... It just goes against every rule of evolutionary psychology, what they've done.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, evolutionary psychology talks about averages and it talks about kind of you know, because like the base rate of mistreatment in general is quite low. And so, yes, like step parents and adoptive parents in these kinds of situations can be there's a higher risk factor, but also like any individual case. And I think especially for like religious families and, you know, families that, you know, at least attempt to override those biases. But no, for my sister and I, there was never any of that.
They weren't like strict.
My adoptive parents.
Yeah,
not really. They were my adoptive father was a little bit strict, but overall not too strict.
But then again, so I mean, I just think it's such an appalling, as you say, troubled. So you get adopted. Mm. That should be it. That should be now you have a nice stable upbringing to compensate or help to try and compensate for all the instability you've experienced, and then they selfishly get divorced.
Yeah, that was. You know, it was harder, I think, on my sister actually than me, because by that point I was so used to kind of these tumultuous upheavals in my life. But my sister, I think for her, it was devastating even more so than for me, because these were the only parents she had ever known, and to witness their marriage dissolve was really hard on her. For me, it was hard, but not the divorce itself wasn't that hard. It was more so losing contact with my adoptive father that was harder. Moving back between the homes and changing, you know, environments and everything wasn't that difficult for me. After my father stopped speaking with me, I was raised by my adoptive mother. She was a single mother by this point, and so we lived in this kind of gloomy duplex in town, and she was working full-time, and I was a latchkey kid. I'd walk to school, walk home, hang out with other kind of miscreant boys in the neighborhood, and that's something that I... So that was one reason why... one reason among many why I titled my book Troubled is because I was a troublemaker and, you know, responded the way a lot of boys respond in those circumstances. And, you know, there was a lot of drama, you know, with my mother, and seeing my sister go off to her father's place. And then,
he lived with her.
I'm sorry. One second. I'll just take a picture so that they can see where we are. Sorry about this.
Yeah.
Okay.
He lived with her. She lived with him.
Well, initially we would spend 1 week with him and then 1 week with our mother. And then eventually, you know, my mother got full custody of me. And then my sister from that point forward would just visit, you know, her dad and stay with us. And
well, you fell out with him.
Yeah. Well, yeah. He, after the divorce, he was angry at my mother for leaving him and was going through something. And so he retaliated by cutting off contact with me.
I have run up.
Yeah. So.
All right. So how did you move to starting to do well at school?
Well, it was, I mean, this is one of those things where I'm generally in agreement with, you know, the whole intelligence and heredity and all those kinds of things. But, you know, you can have, I think intelligence is necessary but not sufficient to do well academically. Obviously, you need that raw level of intellectual capacity. But if it's not cultivated and you don't have the kinds of environmental structures in place to allow that ability to manifest itself, then you're going to see a kid struggle. And that was my story, where when I was in the homes, no one could ever tell that I was smart. They thought I might have been dumb. And then initially after I was adopted and I had this family structure that was very stable, my grades improved. I was like one of the top kids in the school spelling bee and I was doing very well. After the divorce, my grades also sharply plummeted again. And so it was kind of these upswings and downswings. I was responding to my environment in this way. There's also the matter of, there's also the matter of, I think resentment and animosity play a role here, and this is like also often overlooked in these discussions, is I was a really angry kid because of everything that I had gone through. And so if a teacher or an adult or an authority figure said, oh, you should do your homework, here's your science project, you should be reading. And in my mind, I would think like, fuck you, I don't want to do that. Like I just had this kind of oppositional stance on everything, where sometimes a teacher, a very observant teacher, could recognize that I was a smart kid and would ask me what was going on or why I'm not trying harder. And in my mind, I would just like retaliate or feel like I don't want to do what you're telling me to do. Mm-hmm. And there was also, I think, a bit of unwillingness to accept that I was a smart kid too.
But,
you know, I think part of it was that.
Yeah.
I would have had to raise my sights for myself, and I just did not know where my life was headed. I didn't have high hopes, and if I accepted that I was smart, yeah, then I would have actually had to apply.
You would force you to have high hopes and, yeah, and fail them personally.
Yeah, and so I was, you know, there was a little bit of that self-defeating behavior.
And my understanding is that the Army was what, you went into the Army?
Air Force.
In the Air Force, I'm sorry, and this is before university or whatever.
Yes,
and this is what altered things. So tell me a bit about that. Why did you go into the Air Force?
Well, by this point, I was kind of facing down my final year of high school. I was 17 years old, and I was in the bottom of my high school class. I graduated, but just barely. And I knew I wasn't headed off for university. And in the town that I grew up in, the only way you leave that town is either you go to university or you join the military. And I was not, my grades and my, you know, I just was not in a position to study at that point. So I'd heard from, you know, various people, oh, the military might be an option, decided to enlist. And I was the Air Force in particular, because my high school history teacher, he recommended the Air Force because he had been in the Air Force. And then my friend's father had also been an Air Force veteran. And they said, oh, Air Force, you know, it might be a good path for you. And so, you know, I enlisted shortly thereafter and went off to basic training. And, you know, there were some missteps and mistakes that I had made along the way, which I write about. But ultimately, that was the structure I needed in order for my ability to be fully expressed.
So it was like the Simpsons episode where she goes to military school and they talk about poetry in a militaristic fashion, and Lisa loves it. It brings out her intelligence, or their intelligence, even more.
Yeah. Well, I think there is something to be like, if you are a high IQ, high conscientiousness person, and you have parents who have high IQs and are very conscientious, then you can have a bit of a free range, unsupervised childhood where there are very few dangers around you for you for your life trajectory to veer off course. But I think that if you take a kid who's very bright and very hardworking and intelligent, but you put him in the environment that I grew up in, there aren't that many opportunities, one, for that ability to manifest itself. And then there are plenty of opportunities for you to make catastrophically poor decisions, especially when you're around a lot of other people like that. You know, there's that whole line about like the worst part of growing up poor is being around poor people. It's like, even if you're smart and everyone around you is impoverished and, you know, has high time preference and all these other kinds of factors, that, you know, it's almost better to be dumb and surrounded by smart people than to be smart surrounded by dumb people. Yeah, and so in those circumstances, it was hard. But then it took the standardized test to go into the military. And a lot of people aren't aware that there's a standardized test to enter the military. And so there, you know, you have to meet a certain kind of intelligence threshold to enlist. And then it's even higher for the officers. And so I go off to the Air Force and I'm around people who are actually reasonably intelligent and capable. And a lot of these people were curious and bright. And so being around those kinds of people, I think, in addition to the kind of the structure and the mindset and all the other tools that I was equipped with, that helped me to accept that I was, you know, a brighter person than I originally thought, and that I could actually go off to university and maybe even one of the good ones.
And that's what you then did.
Yeah, yeah. So I went off to Yale on the GI Bill, which is this program the military pays for tuition for veterans. And so I went off to Yale and, you know, I noticed a lot of interesting things. I arrived there in 2015. I kind of witnessed the early...
How old were you?
I was 25.
So you had a bit of an advantage over the 18-year-olds then in terms
of life experience.
Raw intelligence goes up with age and all that.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, Maybe. I think that probably didn't hurt. And so, yeah, in addition to the kind of the maturity, I think conscientiousness also increases with age as well.
Yes, it does.
And so I was more disciplined with my studies than I would have been at age 18. And, you know, that was where I first witnessed a lot of the kind of strange and silly elite beliefs. Sometimes I call them luxury beliefs.
Yes, yes.
Of the, you know, the modern upper class, the elites, people who go to these kinds of prestigious universities, but hold strange ideas about everything, including human nature. And so I was a psychology major at Yale, and I think there was one course the entire time where they mentioned intelligence, and it was in a course about autism. And otherwise, I heard nothing about intelligence. And it wasn't until my second year at Yale, Charles Murray was invited by one of the conservative student groups to deliver a talk about Coming Apart, his book that came out, you know, years ago. I listened to that talk, and he mentioned IQ, and I was intrigued. So I read Coming Apart, and then I looked up Charles Murray and saw that he had written The Bell Curve. And then I read The Bell Curve and I thought, oh, like this helps me not only to understand kind of the increasing kind of stratification and class divides in the country, but also a little bit of my own life. I think, you know, Charles Murray's, you know, for me, he's one of the best living social scientists, but he helped me to understand that intelligence matters and that it's important and that it's, you know, extremely powerful predictor of life outcomes. But then also, especially with Coming Apart and in parts of The Bell Curve, too, you know, he also points out that for people who are less intellectually inclined and aren't academically equipped to do well in school, they need guidance and they need elites in society to help them make wiser decisions.
And that's what they used to do.
Yes. And that isn't the same thing as stripping their freedoms or telling them, you know, in this very coercive way, you have to behave this way or that way, but just to promote good values overall. Like there are better and worse ways to live your life. And this way is better and this way is worse. And sometimes, you know, there's a lot of elite hypocrisy today, but what I prefer is what I sometimes call the John F. Kennedy model of elite hypocrisy, which is that if you look at someone like John F. Kennedy, we all know today that he was a very flawed man. He was a philanderer, absentee father, you know, abused drugs, but the public image he presented to the world and to the country is that he is a devoted husband, a good family man. You know, it was important that despite his inability to live up to those ideals, he still thought those ideals were important to champion to the people. And now we have almost the reverse of this situation where publicly elites either take a non-judgmental approach or openly promote behaviors that lead to catastrophe. but then privately behave in a very disciplined way.
It's quite an adaptive thing to do because it's basically cutting out the competition. I mean, these people are your competition for status.
Yeah.
You are telling them, oh yeah, you know, speak in a black way or don't try hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or don't try hard at school because it's subjective or there's no such thing as truth or whatever. Mm. But you don't really believe that and you don't act according to it. But if you persuade others, like I don't know if you know Lipton Matthews, he's a Jamaican researcher, he's a good friend. I podcast with him every week. And he has this, what he calls it, black privilege. And he talks about this idea that you get these black elites that will say to other blacks, oh, yeah, you know, could take on your culture and it's all subjective and you're being discriminated against and there's no point trying. And they don't act like that. They act as though they have free will and they can get right to the top. And so consequently, they are eliminating the competition by teaching them to behave in essentially a maladaptive way while they themselves don't. It's very... And luxury beliefs could be argued to do something like that.
Yeah.
You get other people, you inculcate other people with luxury beliefs, and you say you believe them. But on a sort of either with an unconscious level, or you don't act like you believe them.
Yeah, yeah. The revealed preference idea of look at what people do, not at what they say. And I saw a lot of this. I've spent now almost a full decade in and around elite universities and elite university graduates. And yeah, they, you know, talk out of both sides of their mouths. I think it was maybe Amy Wax who said they walk the 50s and talk the 60s. And it's you know, that I think to me that encapsulates it, right?
Yeah,
that
so I interviewed her a while ago on. Oh, yes, that's so true. That's so true.
Yeah, yeah.
So really, your advice to young people that were watching this, perhaps if any of you are watching this and you are troubled, as Rob was, is to walk the 50s. I mean, that's quite a good summary, isn't it?
Yeah. And maybe talk the 50s as well.
Walk and talk the 50s, chaps. And talk the 50s. And read Rob's book, which is Troubled, which they've deliberately kept off the bestseller list, I understand.
It was there was something strange going on there where the book should have made the New York Times bestseller list, but it was intentionally kept off. And I wrote about this. The Economist actually did a whole analysis of what happened with my book and why it was left off the list. So you can, you know, look that up and read about that online too, that the New York Times list is not a bestseller list. It's a curated list. So
it's a walking the 60s list rather than 50s list. Okay, well, I'd like to thank Rob for coming on. It's been extremely interesting. Thank you very much. I will see you all soon, chaps, and goodbye.
Are you ready for the future of the West?